So we don't investigate directly the rich, but we investigate the Swiss elite, and we will see that it's, of course, strongly connected. If you blame toxic masculinity, if I took the terms, for the financial crisis, then you avoid, of course, addressing, in my opinion, the real problem. So financial deregulation and the wider structural problem inherent in capitalism. We see that even if there was some change, less old, maybe less white, but still no women, but at least there was some changes.
Diese Stimme gehört Stefanie Ginalski. Sie ist Elitenforscherin. Sie beobachtet und erforscht die Schweizer Elite, also die Reichen und Mächtigen im Land. Stefanie Ginalski ist Historikerin und Dozentin am Institut für politische Studien der Universität Lausanne. Und uns erklärte sie an diesem Vortrag, wer die Reichen sind, wie sie ticken und auch, wie sie sich verändern. Den Vortrag, den ihr gleich hört, hielt Ginalski im November 2022 im Bernischen Historischen Museum. Viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
Okay, vielen Dank, Anna, und guten Abend. Also, es tut mir leid, dass ich die Klischees über die Roman, die sehr schlecht Deutsch sprechen, aufrechterhalte, aber ich denke, es ist angenehmer, wenn ich die Konferenz auf Englisch vorsetze, also I will turn to English now. So thank you very much for inviting me to this great festival. I think it's very important for the academic world to get out of the academic walls, so I'm very happy to be here tonight. So I wanted to say a few words about who I am and where I speak from, but Anna just did it. So yeah, just so you know that my main area of interest are elite sociology, as well as the transformation of capitalism during the 19th and 20th century. So I have this kind of interdisciplinary approach between history and sociology. So as she said, I would like to speak about the rich, but also the elite. And maybe I will have three general questions that I would like to address during the talk. The first one is, who are the rich in Switzerland? The second one is, who are the elite in Switzerland, and more specifically, the corporate elites? And then also I will discuss a little bit how these two issues are related. So I will start with a very general consideration, and then I will give more concrete and empirical results regarding the Swiss case. So let me start with this very famous quote of Warren Buffett. Maybe you heard it already. Warren Buffett is an American businessman, a philanthropist. He is considered as the sixth wealthiest man in the world. So he's really if we talk about rich people, he's really among the richest. And he quite unabashedly declared in 2006, during an interview with a journalist of the New York Times, "There's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making the war, and we are winning." So I think this quote is quite illustrative of how the issue of wealth and inequality have been making a huge comeback, both in academic and public debates for some time. And it's also quite illustrative of how it is connected to other questions that were maybe a little bit forgotten for some time, such as the class warfare mentioned by Warren Buffett. So, like all topical issues, this question of wealth and power inequality is also, of course, dealt with in films and series, such as, for example, Succession. I don't know if you've seen it. It's kind of a great, I think, TV show on business elites, but also wealth and family capitalism. So if you haven't seen it yet, I can recommend it. And don't be put off by the first two episodes, which are clearly not very good, but the rest of the series is really, I think, a great series and says a lot about capitalism, family capitalism, and as the title indicates, the issue of succession among families. Another example is The movie Triangle of Sadness I saw quite recently with some friends who are in the room, which is a satire of the ultra-rich. And the movie actually won the Palme d'Or in Cannes. And maybe you can, I don't know if you can read it, but it's written that's the perfect comedy for our times. So just two examples to see how it has become, again, a really very popular issue and theme. The ever-widening gap between the richest and the poorest has also been increasingly debated and criticized in the public area. I think in particular, since the 2008 financial crisis, and then of course the COVID crisis again put the question at the center of the debates. So here you have a picture of the Occupy Wall Street movement. The picture dates was taken in 2011. So Occupy Wall Street, I guess you all know what it is. It's a protest movement that was initiated in New York against economic inequality with a very central argument, which is we are the 99%, as you can see on the picture. And the idea is that the 99% of the population, as opposed to the 1% of the wealthiest, doesn't want to be silent anymore and doesn't want to be silenced anymore. We can also, of course, think of the Gilets Jaunes movement in France, a little bit more recent, which is a kind of a heterogeneous movement that denounced, amongst other things, the growing poverty of a large population of France and a large population of French workers. And the claim that you can see also on the picture is the idea, among others, that it's not fair to work all day long just for the minimal wage. And it was one of the central arguments of this protest movement. And then, more here in Switzerland, we have this initiative that was proposed by the Young Socialists. We voted on it last year, and they were calling for higher taxation of capital income, so notably on interest and dividends. And as you know, the initiative was rejected, but anyway, it again provoked a huge debate in the society. And again, you find this idea of the 99%, the majority of the population, which want to have more, at least some part of the privilege that the wealthiest have. So, of course, all these questions, all these issues have also been debated in the humanities for a long time. But I think here again, we have kind of a renewed interest quite recently. And maybe you've heard of Thomas Piketty. He's a French economist who specialized in the study of economic inequality, in particular in a very long-term and a comparative perspective. And he published in 2013 Le Capital au XXIe siècle, which became a huge bestseller, which is not so frequent for a book written by an economist. And I think there are maybe three arguments which are quite important and interesting for what interests us tonight. The first one is the fact that, according to him, inequalities have increased since the 70s after a short reduction. The second argument is the idea that the inequality regarding capital are much more important than inequality related to paid employment. So, in other words, it means that there is a very strong social reproduction of inequalities over time, notably through inheritance, and it's difficult to reduce the gap even if you have a well-paid salary. The last argument is, there are many other, but the maybe three that I would like to point out for this conference, is the idea that inequality, according to him again, is much more domestic than international. So it pits the rich against the poor within each country rather than between different countries. So I won't develop this question further because I know there is another conference on the issue of inequalities, but of course it's clearly related to the question Wer sind die Reichen. So then you have another book of Thomas Piketty, and I just realized while I prepared the conference that it was just this year, I think, there is a comics on capital and ideology, but I don't know what it's worth. I just realized that yesterday was I was finishing to prepare the conference. So that's for a general introduction. And now I would like to address more specifically the issue of what about Switzerland? And maybe what I can say is the fact that the subject is relatively little discussed in comparison to other countries such as France, for instance. This is notably related to the fact that we have like a certain political stability in Switzerland. You have this idea of a quiet country, neutral country. So this is probably part of the explanation. But there is also another explanation that was already underlined in this book by Karl Holliger, which was published in the early 70s, Die Reichen und die Superreichen in der Schweiz, where he kind of criticized the tradition of a certain discretion, but also certain opacity of the Swiss elites. And notably through this quote, where he says, Reich sein bedeutet in der Schweiz jedoch etwas anderes als der übrigen Welt. Die Reiche in der Schweiz hasst nicht so sehr, als wenn seine Umgebung und um seinen Reichtum weiß. So, and I think it's there is really a difference between France, for example, and Switzerland regarding how we speak about elite, what do we know about elite, and it's also related, yeah, to maybe a less good access to the archives, for instance. So if we come back to the question, who are the rich? Probably you all have heard about this list that are made by Bilance. So every year since the early 90s, Bilance produced a list of, at first it was about the 100 richest Swiss people. And then it was about the 300 richest person in Switzerland. So they included also foreigners in the list, which was not the case at the beginning. And you have the French version that you can see on the left and the German on the right. And I think I read them quite often. They give really very useful information on the richest families and individuals in Switzerland. But then, of course, we need also some historical and political explanation to help us to understand who are in the list, but also who are not in the list. And I think that the second question is just as interesting as the first one, if not more so. So that's what we were aiming to do with my colleagues and my research group for now the last 15 years, I would say. And as Anna said, we are working in the Swiss Elite Observatory. So just a few words about what does elite mean, what do we mean when we speak about elites. It's notably related to a book that was published in 1956, if I'm not wrong. At least it was in the 50s, by Wright Mills, who is an American sociologist. And he published a book called The Power Elite, where he criticized the fact that there was a little circle of people in America that had that held position of power in the economic, political, and military sphere. So maybe today we could say, oh, yes, of course, we know that. But at the time, it was kind of an heterodox approach. And he really wanted to call into question this idea of a very democratic and meritocratic society in the United States. So in line with the work of Mills, we also wanted to shed some lights on who are the people who might be considered as elite in Switzerland. Because also what is useful with the concept of elite is the fact that you can, we define them as the people who hold position of power in society. So on the one hand, it's more easy to identify than the rich people, because for the rich people, you don't have access easily to the information, especially for the earlier period. So we don't investigate directly the rich, but we investigate the Swiss elite, and we will see that it's, of course, strongly connected. So again, the concept is referring to people holding position of power in society, and it's also, I think, interesting because You don't speak only of people who have wealth, but you speak also of people who has wealth, but who make decisions that have an impact on other people in the society. So, for example, I'm less interested, let's say, in football players who, of course, are among the wealthiest, but maybe their decisions do not have such a huge impact as the one of the people heading the multinationals, for instance. Then we look at who are the elite in different spheres of power in the society, so the economic sphere, the political sphere, the administrative sphere, the military sphere. Now we are also investigating the cultural sphere. And one thing maybe that we can say, probably you all know this already, but it's useful to keep in mind the fact that there is a Swiss specificity, which is the militia system. So it means that, for instance, those who hold an elite position in the political sphere, for example, the people who are in the parliament, often do so alongside another professional activity. The same for the army. We don't have a professional army in Switzerland. We have a militia army. So this clearly contributes also to kind of strong interpenetration between the different spheres of power. And so we have created this Swiss Elite Observatory. We are quite an interdisciplinary team, so some of us are historians, others are sociologists, political scientists. So it's really a collective work, and we are gathering information on Swiss elites from the beginning of the 20th century and now even from the end of the 19th century until today. And we gather biographical information on these people, and we have collected them in a database, which is publicly available. You can see the link on the slide. We have also a blog where we publish some article, and we try also to sometimes to do summarize of the scientific and academic article to spread a little bit the result of our research outside the academic world. So this is a picture of the database, and you can use them for free, and you can look for people or for firms, and you will find information. So now I think we have information on 20,000 people. Then not all the people have the same data, the same amount of data, but anyway, you can find some information on the Swiss elites. This observatory, as I said, look also at political elite, administrative elite, cultural elite. But today I will really speak about business elite, because business elites are really among the rich, clearly more than the other categories of elites. So again, a short and quick definition. What do I mean by business or more specifically corporate elites? It's the men and few women who are in a position to exercise an important influence over decision and politics of large companies. So again, this idea that these people are in position to take decision, and they take this decision and it has an impact on the people who works for them, and of course, more generally speaking, in the society where we live. And when we discuss a little bit about who are the rich, who are the elites, most of the time, these corporate elites, so the people who are sitting on the board or executive directors of the largest, I really speak here about the largest firms in terms of capitalization, turnover, number of employees. So most of the time, these people clearly belong to the richest person. But then again, of course, the richest do not necessarily belong to the corporate elite. I gave just before the example of football players, for instance. Of course, they are not among the corporate elite. So it's really a part of the richest person that I will speak about during the rest of the conference. So what I would like to do now is to give you some insight about the evolution of the profile of the corporate elite in Switzerland from the beginning of the 20th century until today. And if we analyze this evolution, I think there is an expression that is kind efficient to describe who are the people we are talking about. It's the expression of the old boys network, the Swiss old boys network. And this is true for the largest part of the 20th century, so from the beginning of the 20th century until the end of the 80s. So what does this old boys network mean? In fact, it's an expression which is very often used to describe the corporate elite, generally speaking, not only in Switzerland. And it's really related to the idea that these people are mostly men. As you can see here on the picture, it's a typically picture of a board of direction of Nestlé in 1986. And you see Paul Yolus, who was the chairman of Nestlé, chairing the board. And you see around the table the board member. So you have only men, quite old men, only white men. So this is a typical picture of board of director of a large firm in the Western world at that time. And this expression of the old boys network also refer to the fact that these people have a certain class cohesion, which is based, of course, on the fact that they are sitting on the same board of directors, but which is based also on the fact that they have links outside the business world, such as friendship ties, family relationships, similar educational profile, which also contribute to explain why certain people do sit on this board and why certain people do not sit on this board. If we now dig a little bit in this idea of old boys network, maybe I would like to insist on three dimensions more specifically. The first one is the very strong persistence of family capitalism in Switzerland during the 20th century, even in the largest firms and in the multinational. So it's not only family capitalism is not only about small and medium enterprises. If you look at the 100 largest multinational, most of them are owned, or at least the family is a major shareholder, at least until the 80s. And still today, family capitalism is really important, even again in this very big multinational. So here I put an example of related to the machinery and metal industry, which became the most important industrial sector in Switzerland during the interwar period. So you can see on the picture Emil Georg Burle. Probably you heard about him also, and that's why, of course, I took the example. So he's a German citizen. He took over a machine tool company in Oerlikon, so in the region of Zurich, during the interwar period. And then he transformed it into a flagship of the Swiss arms industry. And he really made a fortune during the Second World War, notably because his company exported weapons to the Axis and notably to Nazi Germany. Like many other Swiss industrialists, he also became an important art collector. And you have maybe heard about the huge controversy regarding the transfer of his art collection to the Kunsthaus in Zurich. It has provoked very important controversy and debates in Zurich, because on the one hand, most of the of this artwork that you can see on the picture, on the left picture, were bought thanks to the export of arms during the Second World War, and also because an important part of this artwork were bought to Jews in, of course, very difficult circumstances for these people during the second, just before and during the Second World War. So on his death in 1956, Emil Georg Burle, the firm of Emil Georg Burle is transferred to his children. His son, notably Dieter, took over the company. The daughter is also sitting on the board of director, but she held less important position. She was mostly dealing with the art foundation. And this is an example among many, many others similar. You probably all have in mind some important families in Switzerland, such as the Sulzer, the Schindler, the Roche family, who were able to keep the company across the decades, the centuries sometimes, sometimes until today. But to put it quickly, it means that you had almost no chance of owning or running a large company if you did not come from an upper class family. So it's not really a big surprise, you will say, but I think it's important to keep that in mind. And it's clearly related to what we said about Thomas Piketty at the beginning of the conference. So this idea that there are a strong social reproduction of capital, and that this create huge inequality in the society still today, and even more since the 70s. The second thing I found interesting too, and I would like to discuss a little bit with you, is the fact that for a long time we had a very Swiss elite. So here you have a table showing the proportion of foreigners among corporate elite of the largest Swiss firms for different benchmark years across the period I'm talking about. And you can see, so the N indicates the number of persons. So it means that, for example, in 1910, you had 11% of foreigners for 800 directors of the largest Swiss firms, the 100 largest Swiss firms. So you see this first phase, which is a phase that was described by some historians as the first globalization, that took place in the end of the 19th century until the First World War, and where you can see that we have some foreigners sitting on the board of the largest Swiss firms. Not that many, but anyway, 11%, it's quite important if you compare to the following decades. But then we can't really speak about globalization because it's mostly German person, some French person, and also some Italian person. So really, countries that are very close, that have common borders with Switzerland, common languages, so we can't really speak about internationalization or globalization. And it's a huge difference with the current situation, and I will come back to this point later. So then you have a second phase, which can be described and which has been described by some observators, and notably foreign observators, as the fortress of the Alps, meaning that it was very difficult for foreigners to get access to the board of directors of the largest Swiss firms. There was a strong fear of Überfremdung, both in Swiss society and in the business sphere. So it means that you can see like a process of nationalization, not of the firms, but of the board of directors. So you see that the percent of foreigners is decreasing. There was a rule stipulating that most of the board members had to live in Switzerland if they wanted to be board member of Swiss firms. During the 60s, there was also a gentleman agreement between bankers and industrialists, in which bankers agreed not to sell shares to foreigners without the agreement of the board member of the firm. So you really see a strong cooperation among the elite, and notably among the business, among the industrialist and financial elite, to, you know, keep the firms safe from outsiders. And outsiders means foreigners, but it means also women, and it means also people from the lower classes. Then you have the more recent period, since the end of the 20th century, and it's a period of globalization. And here you see clearly a strong increase in foreigners. 2015, 36 foreigners, this is huge. This is really huge if you compare even to other small countries with a very open economy, such as the Netherlands, which is quite similar to Switzerland. They don't have that high amount of foreigners. And it has increased since we have, I think, 42% in 2020. The difference also is the fact that now these foreigners came from not all around the world, but anyway, you have some foreigners coming from the United States, from some so-called developed Asian countries. Some regions remain totally excluded. For example, African countries, you have almost no one, with one exception I will talk about later. But anyway, it's not a full globalization, but it's more globalized than it was before the First World War. But before I come to the recent change, let's stay on this idea of old boys network until the end of the 80s and 90s. This is a concrete example of what we call, when we do social network analysis, which I did for my PhD actually. So the idea was to see the links between the firm through people sitting on multiple boards. This is typically a big linker. So the name is Rainer Gut. He was the main executive director of Credit Suisse around the end of the 70s. And at the same time, he was sitting on the board of 10 large, very large industrial and financial firms. So at the same time, he really held this multiple position of power in different firms. Notably, maybe the most well-known are AluSuisse, Nestlé, Sulzer, Sebag, IBG, or Swissair. So this is very illustrative of, first, the fact that many bankers sat on the board of industrial firms, and conversely, you found many industrialists also sitting on the board of the largest Swiss banks. And this is then illustrative of kind of a process of self-regulation between these elites. So we are not really in a very competitive liberal system. You know, it's really very self-regulated. You have this very dense and cohesive network of elites who stay together. And as I said before, it's also the aim to exclude intruders or outsiders, such as foreigners, people of lower classes, but also women, which is my next point. So family capitalism, the very Swiss elite, and also it's really a male stronghold. So here you see now not the proportion of foreigners, but the proportion of women among corporate elites, still in the 100 and largest Swiss firms. And you clearly see that during more than the first half of the 20th century, you have almost no women. Interestingly, you have some women, but very, very few. It's not even one person. It's again in a period where you have a strong family capitalism, as I said before, which was clearly largely a patriarchal system still today. Anyway, the things are a little bit changing now, but at the time it was really clearly very patriarchal. So usually the business was passed on to the sons, as we saw with the example of Burla just before, or sometimes to the sons-in-law, where they were not male heritors or when they were not interested in taking over the business, but never to the daughters. Of course, this is not a Swiss specificity. You see exactly the same in other Western countries. What is, however, specific to Switzerland is maybe two things that we have to keep in mind to understand that the situation was especially complicated for women. The first one is, of course, the fact that women did not have the right to vote and to be elected before at the national level before 1971. And the second thing is the fact that until 1988, women needed their husband, married women needed their husband's consent to engage in paid employment. So 1988, it's really, really late. And it also helped to explain why Switzerland is so late when you compare to other countries regarding the situation of women. You have the second phase during the 80s, where you see a small increase in the number of women compared to the previous decade. It's not crazy; it's a 2%, but at least it's a little increase. This is a period marked by what some people call the second wave of feminism. A wave that began in the early 60s and lasted roughly two decades, and a period marked really by a claim, notably by women, to have a better access to the labor market. And then you have the last phase. We have discussed just before the period of the globalization, and it also had an impact on the entrance of women. And I think actually it's the most important factor explaining the increase in women. Notably because it was related to the huge rise in what we could call neoliberal feminism. And I will come back to this point at the end of my conference. So, to sum up, for the greatest part of the 20th century, the profile of the Swiss corporate elite, and thus of a large part of the richest people in Switzerland, was quite stable. So the typical figure was, as we have seen, an older man of Swiss nationality. Usually he had studied either law or engineering study at university, or he had completed an apprenticeship, especially in the banking sector. The apprenticeship was very important. And most of the time he had also made a career in the Swiss army. We have already discussed that in Switzerland we have a militia army, and for a long time it was really important to have made a career in the army because it gave the impression that you had some leadership capacity. So you really see a clear overrepresentation of the people having made a career in the Swiss army among the corporate elite. Of course, you will always find exceptions that prove the rule, but on the whole, if you are, again, a woman, a foreigner, or a person from the lower classes, you had almost no chance of becoming part of this elite. So now the question is, to what extent did things change at the end of the 20th century? And the answer is, it did change. On one side, it did change, and on another side, it did not change at all. And this will be the last part of my presentation. So we do observe during the last three decades a partial fracturing of the Swiss corporate elite. And this was related notably to external pressure. I have already mentioned the globalization and the internationalization of the elite. So it had an impact because most of the time foreigners do not sit on multiple boards, such as Rainer Guth, as we have seen before. You had also the rise of financial capitalism, and the strategy of the firms became increasingly shareholder value oriented. So what does it mean? To put it short, it means that the firms must generate as much profit as possible in a short time for the shareholders of the firm. And this is really a change of strategy in the firms. It started in the United States, and then you see it also in Switzerland since the end of the 20th century. And it really led to increasing competition among firms and among corporate elites. The rise of the transnational business feminism, I will again come back on this point in a few minutes. But what I would like also to say, it's not only external pressure. You also find people in the Swiss elite that want to introduce these changes. And we could describe them as new elites compared to the previous one. And it's also related to the fact that this elite became more and more divided on some topics, such as European Union, for example. There were strong divisions among the corporate elites on this question. So there were also internal pressure, which contribute to explain that this elite was not so much a very cohesive old boys network as before. So I would like to finish with two examples, which I find interesting. The first one is the changing profile of the Credit Suisse CEOs. I think it's very illustrative. What happened in the Credit Suisse during the last three decades is very illustrative of the changing profile of the Swiss elite, generally speaking. So let's start with Joseph Ackermann, who was born and who studied in Saint-Gall, so he's a Swiss citizen. He was a colonel in the Swiss army, and so like his predecessors, like Rainer Guth I mentioned before, typically, he's clearly the man from the fortress of the Alps. Then a few years later, you have the first non-Swiss CEO of Credit Suisse, Oswald Grubel, who was, as I said, the first non-Swiss person heading to the top position in the Credit Suisse. A few years later, you find Brady Dugan, who was the first American. So Oswald Grubel was German, and Brady Dugan was the first American to be at the head of the Credit Suisse. And he is also the man who thought we have 8 federal councilors in Switzerland. I think it was an interview in the Tagesanzeiger. The journalist asked him how many federal councilors we have in Switzerland. He said, oh, I don't know, maybe 8. And I think the fact that he does not know is very illustrative also of the change in foreigners that we do find in Switzerland. So if you remember the example of Emil Gorbürle, he's a German citizen, but then he come in Switzerland, he asked for the Swiss nationality, then he start buying artwork, he enters in the Zürcher Kunstgesellschaft, so he really became very integrated in the Swiss society. And this is mostly the case for the foreigners who were sitting on the board of the largest firms during the first half of the 20th century. Brady Dugan is much more illustrative of this moving director. So they are in a firm in a country and then in a firm in another country, and they do not necessarily stay in Switzerland, and they do not sit on multiple boards as some foreigners did at the beginning of the 20th century. Then we have Tidiane Thiam. He's a Franco-Ivorian, which is really unimaginable during the previous decade to have someone coming from partially an African country heading the Credit Suisse. You really couldn't imagine that during the 80s. So on the one hand, things change a little bit. And on the other hand, he had to resign during the scandal that shook the bank over the accusation of spying and shadowing around 2018 and 19. So he was described by the New York Times as the sole black CEO of the Swiss banking system. And they also wrote a whole article when he had to resign, saying that there were problems of racism in the bank. And it was the fact that not only he was black, but he was not really part of the Zurich establishment. He never was really well integrated. And according to the New York Times, he was like really pushed out of the bank. And the last one, Ulrich Körner. So he is the chief of Credit Suisse now. So Bilance, it's not my terms. Bilance magazine wrote an article saying that he has null glamour, viel Verstand und ordentlich Biss. And I think it's also a way to maybe show a partial return to the old figures in the context of the many scandals that have rocked the bank during the last decades. And we always hear about scandals regarding Credit Suisse during these last years and last decades. So we see that even if there was some change, less old, maybe less white, but still no women, but at least there was some changes, we might always come back to the previous situation. Regarding women, I have started the conference with a quote from Warren Buffett, and I would like to finish the conference with another famous quote, which is, maybe you've heard it already, it really spread during the financial crisis in 2008. So this idea that if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, there won't have been a financial crisis in 2008. So you really could read that a lot during the crisis. And it was again said by Christine Lagarde, who is the chief of the International Monetary Fund, quite recently in an interview with The Guardian. And I think it's a very interesting and surprising effect of the financial crisis, how it favored the rise of, I've mentioned it before, transnational business feminism. And this quote is really illustrative of this. So what does it mean? If you read the interview, Christine Lagarde said that male domination of the banking industry made the collapse of Lehman Brothers, so the bank that started the crisis, more likely. She also said that a key ingredient of reform would be a more female leadership in finance. And I think it's kind of problematic to say that kind of things for at least two reasons. The first one is that if you blame toxic masculinity, if I took the terms, for the financial crisis, then you avoid, of course, addressing, in my opinion, the real problem. So financial deregulation and the wider structural problem inherent in capitalism. And the second problem is, of course, that you tend to reproduce gender stereotypes. This idea that women are naturally more reasonable and men would be naturally more risk-taking. And what is interesting is that this alleged feminine characteristic, such as risk aversion, non-competitive behavior, had been perceived for a very long time as really not compatible with leadership. And now they have become more and more value, notably in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And again, it's, I think, a very convenient solution not to address the real problem. So at the end, probably you see changes only on the surface, but not really a real solution to reduce the gap between the poor and the rich. But then maybe my colleague who's speaking about increasing inequalities will come back to this point. So I just wanted to say that if we are interested in the topic of corporate Swiss corporate elites, we have with my colleagues published two books, one in French, one in German. It's the same one, it's just a translation. It's quite short, it's really a synthesis of our result. And yeah, I think I was a little bit too long, I'm sorry about that. So I will stop now. Thank you very much for your attention.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijasiewicz. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.